John Tikaroo Liver Lecture,
April 2019. The guidelines for alcohol consumption for us humans here in England went from halved overnight from December 31st, 2016 to January 2017. So that New Year's Eve went from one number to half because our government, our health department has realized the impact of alcohol on our bodies and the impact on society. So does anybody know, just out of interest, because I looked it up this morning because I forgot the units, how many units we're allowed to drink in a week, or what's recommended?
Men or women?
In a week.
In a week. It's actually the same for both. I thought it was different.
It's strange, because the body mass index is different.
It's true, but it varies with everybody anyway because of the amount of fat that you've got on your body, how tall you are, right? Your body mass index. But does anybody have an idea?
Is it 21 units?
No.
14.
No.
14.
It is 14. I thought it was actually 20. Because, you know, I don't really check that stuff because I'm not a big drinker.
14 a day?
14. No. 14 units in a week. And, of course, you're right. It depends on how you metabolize, how your liver functions, how big you are, how small you are, and how much fat you have throughout your body, because it depends on that especially. So does anybody know what 14 units looks like in a week with alcohol?
Is it about a glass and a half of red wine?
No, like 14 units would be units. 6 pints of beer.
Four.
Is that a lot?
Well, you'd be surprised, some people drink 6 pints on a Friday night when they get paid. I have patients that do that. But also, 14 glasses of wine, either red or white, at 11% at 175 mils is the same amount as the 6 pints of beer. And then the shots, you know, the little vodka shots, 14 of those in a week is equal to the 14 units of alcohol you drink in a week. So just, I want you to be thoughtful about how much you drink, because everybody has a little something. There are some people that don't drink at all, but if there's a message that I personally would like to share with you, is think about your alcohol consumption. And the other thing to mention too, you know, when you do a slow drip feed during the week, it's a lot better than doing it all in one hit. That means having a binge drink, because that puts not only your liver under a lot of pressure, but also your pancreas. It's not just the sugar, it's actually the alcohol, the ethanol, because your liver's got to work really, really hard to break it all down. And of course, with the insulin from the pancreas. Anyway, so just one thing to remember, drink in moderation, and that binge drinking is worse than drinking steadily through the week. Yeah? You run the risk of pancreatitis. It's a nasty disease because it's very difficult to manage. Okay, so we'll start off with the liver. So whereabouts is the liver? What cavity?
Middle.
Exactly. So that's our abdominal. Remember when we talked about cavities of the body last time? We've got our skull, which contains our brain and our brain stem and part of our spinal cord. We've got our thoracic cavity, our abdominal cavity, and our pelvic cavity. So it's in the abdominal cavity and lies on the right-hand side, just below the diaphragm and in front of the right kidney. And the tail extends just across our umbilicus, the area above our umbilicus, our belly button. And sometimes when I do abdominal examinations for patients who have got lower back pain, I've got to work out the differential diagnosis of their back pain, and one of them is actually having an enlarged liver. So I do a liver examination. And your liver should, when you examine it should be about 2 inches, 2 finger breadths below your diaphragm. And it's and you can actually do a specific test to feel, it's called the McMurphy's test, where you can feel where the liver is. You can actually palpate it. Because when you do percussion down somebody's abdomen, it changes from a dull sound to an echoey sound when you move down. I'm going to leave you to work out how to do the examination. You may or may not want to know, but I actually think it's nice to know where the liver is. But if somebody's a big alcoholic or has got liver disease, their liver's going to be big and their abdomen's going to be distended. Now remember, last time I saw you, we talked about edema. And one of the things we talked about was, what was it called?
Ascites.
Ascites. One of the complications of liver disease is ascites. So if you've got a patient that has a big abdomen, but you can feel that it's got water there, fluid, you've got to suspect that it could be liver induced as well as other conditions. So I'm just giving you lots of little tidbits so you can piece it together. So that when you're working as a practitioner, you can think of other causes of a condition. Yeah? Is that okay? Okay. So, as the notes say, the liver weighs about 1 to 2.3 kilograms, depending on how big you are. If you're a small person like me and don't drink too much, it's going to be a normal size. If you've had disease in the past, like for example, if you've been exposed to hepatitis or you've had glandular fever where you get a viral inflammation of the liver, it can be enlarged and it can have some fibrosis. And sometimes it can affect you for many years. But the liver's got an amazing way of regenerating and healing itself. So if you've been a big drinker and you stop, your liver over time will regenerate and get better, not to the full capacity, and there may be some fatty aspects of the liver, but it's an organ that can regenerate. Did you know that if you were to have a liver transplant, usually with a liver transplant, because the liver is in two lobes, they divide it and they can give it to two people that require a liver. And the lobe is only half the size of a normal liver. But once it's inside the recipient, it can grow to the full size. Isn't that crazy? And it stops growing to the capacity and size of that individual. Isn't that crazy? I love knowing how a body can do things like that. Anyway, you can tell I'm a bit excited about all that stuff, and that's why I do what I do. Okay, so focusing on our notes. So on the right-hand side of the body, and it's in front of the right kidney, made up of very soft pinkish-brown tissues, and it's got a lovely capsule around it. I bought a lamb's liver today, so I'll be able to show you the capsule, and even visually, you can actually see the little lobules of the cells that make up the liver, and we can look at that in a moment. We talked about its location, and it's got several major things that hold it in place, and one of them is the coronary ligament, the right and left triangular ligaments, and the fulcruciform ligament. I've actually dissected that stuff already from the liver, so you won't necessarily see it on the specimen that I've got, because a lamb's liver is double the size of a human's liver, but the structure is very similar in the sense that they've got the same cells. But it's double the size. And what I've done, I dissected the liver this morning. I won't even tell you what happened to my fridge. you know what? I got the whole block. I was telling Paul earlier on, I got the whole block from the butcher. I ordered it on Friday, picked it up. I just put it in my outdoor fridge. And actually, didn't think to put it inside a bowl or anything because it was big. And I opened it up this morning. It was like there was a bloodbath in my outdoor fridge. It bled all the way through. But anyway, it's fine. It got all cleaned, don't worry. So it's half of the size of a human's liver, but what I've dissected is the size of a human's liver. Yeah? The shape is just a little bit different, but it's still the same. Okay, so we've got major organs associated with the liver. As we mentioned, we've got the diaphragm at the top that divides the abdominal cavity anteriorly, that means from the top, and of course the anterior abdominal wall at the front. Inferiorly, you've got other organs around the liver, and you can see the diagram there. To the left, you've got the pancreas. And in between the pancreas and the liver, just here, you've got the gallbladder. The gallbladder stores the bile that the liver makes. And bile's really important, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, as one of the functions of the liver. But the bile helps emulsify the fat in your digestion that you eat. So you know how fairy liquid works? You know, when you do the washing up, you put the fairy liquid in your washing up bowl, and if you wash, you know, a plate that's got grease on it, it actually breaks down the big molecules of fat into smaller molecules. And in us, it's broken down into smaller molecules so we can absorb some of that fat in our gut through our digestion system. But when it comes to washing up, it means that the fat cells are smaller and they can go down and into the sewage. And if you don't rinse it properly, you get those big fat balls in the plumbing. Okay, so we talked about, I didn't talk about the other organs where the liver is. So posteriorly, that's behind the liver, you have the esophagus and the vena cava. That's one of the major blood vessels to the liver. And the vena cava also goes to the heart, the aorta, the gallbladder, as we mentioned, and of course the spinal cord. Okay, so the portal fissure is a name given to the posterior surface. That's the surface of the back of the liver, where all the organ, all the vessels leave from the liver. And you've got the vein, and remember, veins carry blood back to the heart. Arteries carry blood away from the heart. Just remember, one is red, that's your arteries, and the other is blue. Now, when we talk about red blood, that means blood that is oxygenated. Yeah, and where does the oxygenation occur in blood?
Lungs.
Great. And what membrane does it cross over? I know, I'm testing you guys, but you may not necessarily know. It's the at the level of the alveoli and the blood. So the alveoli is the end of our lungs. That's where you get diffusion of oxygen and carbon dioxide into the body. So red blood is oxygenated, and that's always away from the heart. So it goes down to our body and goes up to our brain. Blue blood is deoxygenated blood. That means the oxygen has already left and it's going back to the lungs to be circulated and to be oxygenated again. A lot of the times when you look at anatomy diagrams, veins are usually blue. That's a little code. And one day we'll do something on circulation. I think that'd be really helpful.
We can,
We maybe start with circulation because it just makes it a little bit easier. And it's
we can
very
do another
simple.
One, no problem.
Be very, very simple if you had that at the very beginning. And I was making the wrong assumption that you all knew, but you know, you guys come from all different backgrounds. So anyway, a little hint when you're looking at diagrams, because the diagrams you've got in front of you, they've coloured the vena cava as blue for a reason, so that you know that's a clue, it's deoxygenated blood. Yeah? Okay. So we talk about the portal fissure, where all the vessels come out. And then we talk about the blood supply. So you've got the hepatic artery. So remember, artery is always red, and that's blood that's red and oxygenated. So there, you've got the hepatic artery that feeds the liver oxygenated blood, and the portal vein takes away the oxygenated blood. Now, the portal vein is really, really important. You know how we talked about ascites before with one of the conditions of liver disease, or if you've got a problem within the gut? When you have a diseased liver, the pressure builds up inside the liver. And the pressure builds up, and where does the pressure go? It can't go back up to the artery because there's pressure already being forced from the heart. So it goes up the portal vein. And that's really hard because where does the portal vein go? It goes back to the lungs. so that it can oxygenate that blood. So then you get pressure on the lungs, you get pressure on the heart, and you get abnormal blood pressure. And with that, you get more disease. It's really, really unfortunate. When you get that back pressure of pressure from the liver, it makes the veins in the esophagus. Everybody knows that the esophagus is a food pipe and brings the food from our mouth, oh, it's actually at this level, brings the food from our mouth to our stomach. And our stomach has veins and arteries. And if you've got pressure building up in the liver, it puts pressure in the other veins in the abdomen. And this is awful. I can tell you some stories about when you get varicose veins of the esophagus. It's called esophageal varices. Once again, it's one of the effects of having liver disease, in particular alcoholic liver disease, where you get this pressure building up and the veins around the esophagus and inside the esophagus become varicose veins. You know how some people get varicose veins on their legs? I've got them and I'm a bloke. It's because I've been standing on my feet all my life as a nurse and as a chiropractor. But they become bulging and they can rupture and you can bleed. As a nurse, I've looked after a lot of very, very sick adult people in intensive care with rupture of these veins. And it's a medical emergency. Yeah. It's horrible. Horrible what we do to manage that. Anyway, you don't need to know how we manage it. I've got to stick to the script because I go off on tangents because I like to share knowledge. And so that's the blood supply with the liver. The structure, oh yeah, you'll be able to see the little lobules in just a moment. It's made up of all these tiny little hexagonal functional units called lobules. And you can actually see them with a little magnifying glass that I bought on the sheep's liver. And we've got the same pattern in our liver. It's beautiful. I don't know, I like patterns in my life. And you can actually see it, and it's so beautiful. And what I've done, I've sliced a little bit of the outside of the liver, the capsule of the liver, so you can see what it's like just on the inside a little bit. And everybody will get a chance to feel and touch. I know you may not want to touch it, but I bought gloves so you can touch and feel, because it's important. It's cold, don't worry. If you don't want to touch it, that's fine too. But it's really nice to know what it feels like, because it's exactly like a human liver. Yeah. Anyway, so these lobules are visible to the naked eye, and they contain these tiny little things have got lots of little micro veins and arteries that feed back into the portal vein and then goes away. And it gives you I've got a little diagram here that shows you what one of those lobules has. It's got all these tiny little vessels around it. And you've got a picture there, enlarged, of course. And functions of the liver. Like I said at the very beginning, 23 functions of the liver, but we'll break it down into, how many have I got? I think it's 10. 10. Oh, 11. But, you know, you double up a little bit. So, it deaminates amino acids. That means the proteins that you have in your digestion, in your food, it breaks down the little molecules of the protein into amino acids. And like, as human beings, we need the whole 9 essential amino acids in order to grow and function. I think I was talking to you earlier on about vegetarianism. I've got my own views about that stuff, and it's great to eat less meat as adults and be conscious of cholesterol and all that. But if you're going to be a vegetarian or a vegan, you've got to be really clever in order to get the balance of your amino acids correct. You have to be very skilled in understanding the amino acid, content of your legumes, your vegetables, in order to mix them all up to get the full complement. And it's really, really hard. A lot of vegetarians, they supplement with cheese and eggs, which is great. They're getting the other proteins they need. Remember, proteins are made up of amino acids, and as human beings, we need 9 amino acids to function. If you don't have the full complement as a vegetarian or a vegan, there's going to be a deficiency. So if you are a vegetarian or a vegan, be really clever in knowing how you mix all your things to get the most out of your food. And you can get some really good amino acids, protein, through soy-based products, tofu.
But it can inhibit sometimes the thyroid.
Excuse me?
It can inhibit the thyroid function.
Yeah, but you know, thyroid, you're right, it can. But like I said, it's a very personal thing with regards to diet and what you choose to eat. I'm just sharing information with you. It's all about balance, really. Yeah, so... And, you know, I was talking... I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Brigitte.
I was talking to Brigitte earlier on about my views about that stuff. And as a grown man, you know, I have to eat a little meat once a week. Like today's Sunday, I'm doing a little roast dinner this evening. But the other time, I eat fish 3 days a week and vegetarian the other three. But that's my choice. And I feel happy with that. And ethically, I feel better too. But yeah, just be very thoughtful if you're a vegan or a vegetarian that you balance your proteins. And remember, proteins are made up of amino acids, which are the building blocks for us. One of the building blocks. Okay, so it breaks down amino acids into urea, which is important for metabolism. It also breaks down the worn out red blood cells. And you know what they do? What your liver does? It's incredible. It breaks down the red blood cells because red blood cells only live for like 28 days. And when they get tired and worn out, your liver breaks them down, turns them into bilirubin, and that bilirubin is stored in your gallbladder, which is used to colour your poo and also to emulsify the fat. Isn't that amazing? I just think that's incredible.
Sometimes not always like this.
No, it isn't. It isn't, you're right, and you have... issues with stones in the gallbladder tree or stones that can form inside the biliary tree, that's from your liver, from your gallbladder, your pancreas, and you can have issues. You're right. And once again, it's all about balance. Try not to eat too much fatty foods because that stimulates the gallbladder even more. And you know, in traditional Chinese medicine, you know, there are a lot of points for the gallbladder. You'll learn that and you'll understand it more. Okay, so this was important too. So when you break down red blood cells, for example, you get uric acid building up. And in my next talk, we'll talk about what happens when you have too much uric acid. And I think have you ever had gout?
What, uric acid?
No, have you had gout in your big toe?
No, but I've got quite a high uric acid, yeah. But I haven't got gout.
Okay. Some people, the way that they... I don't want to use your example, but I will. Yeah. Some people, the way that their body works, the way it metabolizes things, breaks down, builds up, it can be unbalanced. And some people are naturally like that, and usually it's a familial thing, like their mom and dad were also like that. And if you have high levels of uric acid, it can develop into gout. Has your parents or anybody that you know has had gout? It usually lodges in large joints distally. That means away from the body, big toe. And it's really painful. But we might touch upon that when I do the musculoskeletal system next month. But once again, when you have an imbalance of this uric acid, it can cause problems. And uric acid, whilst we're on the subject, but it will refer to our next talk on the musculoskeletal system. If you're a runner, an athlete, and if you don't stretch enough afterwards, the uric acid that your muscles produce can build up and produce lactic acid as well, and you get the cramps and the pains. So it's not just confined to the liver. It can be lactic acid, uric acid, are products of metabolism, not only in the liver, but also in the muscles. Yeah? But we'll cover that another time. So, we also got the conversion of glucose, which is sugar, to glycogen in the presence of insulin. So, keeping it really simple, your pancreas produces enzymes for digestion, and it produces insulin to make sure that we have a balance of our blood sugar levels in our body. And you know, depending on how you eat, your blood sugars might be peaking and going down, peaking and going down. And that's actually not really nice, because with those peaks and troughs, you get changes in mood, acuity with your mind, being sharp or being tired. And so it's really good to be able to eat so that your blood sugar level is more like that. Now, does anybody know of foods that are great with having a slow release of energy?
Using the GI index.
Yeah.
So things like whole grains.
Exactly.
Slow release.
Exactly. Porridge. Porridge is great because, you know, rolled oats, they're lovely. They're really nutty. And however you cook them or whatever, it's a slow release of energy. So instead of being like this after a Mars bar, or peak and then drop after a Mars bar, when you have rolled oats and nuts, it's more like a slow release, yeah? And I always encourage my patients, my chiropractic patients that I look after, to go for foods that are slow release, so you don't have the peaks and the troughs. And you know, if you're a moody person like I am, ooh, it's not good to have those peaks and troughs, because it exaggerates your mood. Yeah, so just a little thought on that. Okay, and then of course, it's the liver stores the glycogen, and it then transfers it back into glucose in the presence of glycogen. So it's a store for energy. It also, as we talked about, it desaturates fat, emulsifies fat from our digestion that we eat to provide energy. And this is what I forgot about, that the liver actually creates so much heat because it's working so hard. I forgot all about that until I reviewed these notes last week. Oh, there we go. So, we also talked about how it secretes bile. And also it creates the bile pigments. That means the stuff that makes your poo the brown colour. And sometimes a little bit too brown. Whilst on the subject of poo and stools, in Chinese medicine, we talk a lot about poo. We analyse people's poo and their well-being by their poo, their eyes, and their tongue. Is there anything else that I missed?
Urination.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everything.
And sweat.
Yeah, and so everything that you excrete, yes?
I just want to ask you, if somebody has a yellow...
I was just about to talk
about
that.
Yeah, because...
Yes, okay, so I'm sort of digressing, but it is important that you understand.
Yeah, no, this is good.
Because, you know what, I ask all my patients, part of my patient record card is that we talk about that stuff. And as English people, some English people, they're just like, oh my God, they don't even look at the colour of their poo. I say, how do you wipe your ass if you're not looking? So, when you're working with people, don't be embarrassed to ask them, because you get a lot of information about the colour of their poo, their wee, the way it smells.
Yeah, very important.
And it's very, very important. Sweat's another one. Yeah. And, you know, sweat's part of us. You know, it's actually sterile and clean when it comes out of our body. It's when it lays on our body, in our armpits, our groin, our back, whatever, and it gets exposed to the bacteria on our skin, that it starts to smell. As human beings, we have a scent. We're normal. And you know, when I work with people, when I'm adjusting, I can tell without even asking them if they're a vegetarian, if they're a vegan, if they're a meat eater, or they don't eat at all.
From the smell.
Yeah. Smell. But that's because of we've been trained as practitioners to be able to smell people. And I don't mean it in a kinky way. I'm talking about just through experience. Even as a nurse, I could smell and know what's wrong with somebody. I'm talking about easy things. I'm not psychic. I don't have any special powers. Just something that you pick up as you progress and work with people. So, for example, people who eat a lot of fish, Japanese people, they've got a funny little smell about them that's a little bit fishy. People who are vegetarians, They have a grassy smell, like straw. People that are vegans, my God, they smell very different. I don't know if I like it at all. No, it's awful.
What's the vegan smell
though? Yeah. Oh, you know, it's not very pleasant. It's not very pleasant because often enough they don't understand and get the right balance. You know how we talked about balance of amino acids? They don't get the right balance and they smell like they're bad because they're breaking down their own proteins, muscle. And when you get a breakdown of your own body mass, muscle, it smells bad. It smells like rotting
fart all the time.
Yeah, and yes, you have other issues. Lots of flatulence, lots of bad breath. It's horrible. And I've never come across a vegan that knows how to balance their foods properly. I'm digressing, sorry. So, and
I've got one more secretion. Can you mention about extra eye secretion?
Oh, yeah. Now, with extra eye secretions, it can be caused by mechanical problems with the ducts in the eyes. So, for example, if one blocks, you get a dry eye. If you've got... Oh, this is interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
If you've got liver disease...
Yeah, this is right.
Thank you. And you know what? I've got to remember to add this.
Yeah.
I should have added it. If you've got liver disease, it's really weird. You get your skin becomes a little jaundiced, yeah? It becomes yellow everywhere. The whites of your eyes become yellow tinged. Your tears become yellow.
Yeah, the tears as well, right?
Yeah, and your urine. It's very odd. So you can tell...
So it's just the bile being secreted out.
Yeah, because your liver's not functioning properly and the bile can't be stored properly in the gallbladder and it's got to come out somewhere. I'm digressing again, but I'll just talk about babies when they're born. They're always jaundiced within the first 2 days. Because when they're in utero, they're sharing blood from the mother, and you've got all that mixing, and you've got the placenta that filters the blood for the mother, for the baby. When the baby's inside the mother, it's got lots of red blood cells circulating inside. So when the baby's on the outside, and the umbilical cord is cut, it's still got lots of red blood cells inside for that little person. So the baby's a little bit under stress. So that its little liver works to break down the extra red blood cells. And what happens to babies?
Crying.
No, they become a little bit jaundiced. That's normal. But in babies, when they become jaundiced, like in adults, they become sluggish. They don't want to feed. They want to sleep all the time. So what we do, the old-fashioned way, is like, you know, we'll have the little Moses basket. And you put the baby there, expose a little bit of its face, its hands, and let natural sunlight help break down that bilirubin. That's the old-fashioned way. I'm sure, Annie, you would have done that with your kids. But now, if a child or baby is still in special care or in the hospital, they put it under lamps, artificial lamps.
What, infrared or?
No, neon.
Okay.
Neon.
Just neon.
But, you know, the olden days, like when I was born, I was jaundiced. And I was thrown under in front of the window in my little basket. But, you know, I was, you know, hands out, face out. And your body breaks down that bilirubin quickly. And it's broken down. It comes out of your poo and out of your wee. So we're talking about about people's smells. Meat people, man, oh man. And if you're a man on top of that, if you eat a lot of meat, you stink like a real man. All that heavy testosterone man smell. Some girls might like it, some boys might like it, but it's very distinctive. And if somebody has a lot of dairy, they smell sweet like milk. And as you progress as practitioners, you'll pick this up. And these are all little hints that you can absorb and know about your patients when you're not necessarily asking them. You make a little note in your notes. Have you got notes over there? Oh, my Lord, you've done it. I'm so sorry. Sorry, has everybody else got notes? I need you to have notes. I'll always bring some.
There's some medication that can make you smell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my lordy. A lot of antibiotics, a lot of antiviral drugs. A lot of people are on antiviral drugs and we don't realise. And that puts in a huge, we're going to talk about that in a minute, huge pressure on your liver. And you can smell it. One antibiotic in particular, metronidazole. The other name for it is flagyl. It's used a lot with skin infections. Yeah, if you've got a skin infection. Used a lot in dentistry. If you have an abscess in your mouth from teeth being rotten, it smells and tastes. Firstly, as the patient, you can taste this horrible smell. You can't drink when you're on flagyl. Metronidazole, the other name is, yeah?
Can you give it for amoebas or dysentery or something like that? Or bacterial diarrhea or something?
It can be used for a lot of things because it's a broad spectrum antibiotic. Mm. But it's mainly used for bacterial infections that are anaerobic. So that means the bugs, they don't need oxygen to get to grow. So anaerobic means without oxygen, the other name. Aerobic means that it has to be in the presence of oxygen to grow. That's talking about bacteria, viral infections, fungal infections, parasites. They always need air, oxygen, so they can grow and stuff. Yeah? Oh, what have I forgotten? I think that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked, that was from bile. How did I digress? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But, this is a good one. It stores vitamin B12 in particular. And then your body absorbs it through the gut, through the small and large intestine. Now, vitamin B12 is an essential vitamin. People who are vegans, and I've looked after children, babies born to women who are true vegans, who don't balance their vitamins, don't balance their proteins, amino acids in their diet, and if they give birth to a baby with a vitamin, and they have got a vitamin B deficiency, that baby doesn't live. It'll be born with terrible neurological deficit. That means its brain hasn't developed properly, and that baby usually doesn't live. And if it does live, it's a vegetable. So that's why I'm a little bit funny about all this push for veganism, because you know, if you're not, no, I'm not saying that you're thick, but if you're not thoughtful how you mix your proteins, you mix your nutrients in your diet, you have deficiencies. And vitamin B12, you can supplement it, but ideally it's best taken from your diet in a natural way. Yeah?
There's no natural way of taking vitamin B12 as a vegan, unfortunately. So you have to have the supplement.
Yeah, I realise.
So those liver pills, the desiccated liver.
You know, just a basic complex vitamin B would be fine. Yeah. But even some vegans won't touch any supplements because there's something in it that might be not, you know, the bind that they use to stick the nutrients together might come from whatever. But, you know, there are a lot of supplements now that are being made and manufactured for people with special needs, like dietary needs, not special needs of the head, like vegetarians and vegans. One of the supplements we'll talk about in our next discussion, our next talk, is glucosamine sulfate with chondroitin. Normally, that particular supplement comes from fish, shellfish, green-lipped mussels in particular. But now, they've been able to, I don't know how, derive that supplement so that vegetarians would be happy that it doesn't come from crustacean like mussels.
No, my Cairo recommended I take it to my joints, which I didn't. It was amazing. It took about 3 months. It was fantastic.
You know what? It's true, but it depends. You know, I have patients that I prescribe glucosamine chondroitin, and they don't notice no change. I think it depends on the way that you put together your physiology.
Yeah.
You know, you as practitioners, you've got to remember and be thoughtful that one side doesn't fit all. Like a supplement that you might have will be different to how you absorb it, depending on your own physiology, your own chemistry of your body. So as practitioners, you need to be thoughtful of that. In my case, I prescribe it. I actually prescribe a lot of supplementation because you know what? People think they eat really good and they eat terribly. The amount of people, and it's the age group too, I have lots of different age groups. But that age group between 25 and 35, they don't know how to cook. They actually don't know how to cook, not even, maybe they might be able to do an egg on toast with baked beans, and that's it. And they end up eating all this processed food. You know, that Mr. Marks and Spencer's, yeah. Mr. Aldi, Mr. Tesco's, all those little zip, zip, zip meals, I call them. They're fine for emergencies, I reckon. But when you're eating them all the time, did you know that if you buy one of those lasagnas, a microwavable lasagna, I mean, well, the thing is, it is what it is. It's got pasta. It's hopefully got a beef, not a horse meat, mince inside it. Remember the scandal we had 2 years ago? All the supermarkets were tarnished with that horse meat scandal, except Morrison's. Because Morrison's, they grow their own beef, they grow their own sheep, chickens and all that. They don't use a third person or import food, meat, from other countries. That was the only supermarket in our country that didn't have any horse meat brief scandal. Yeah. So anyway, going back to the lasagna. So you've got this beautiful little lasagna that cost you £2.50, say, whatever supermarket. And that food is produced. Usually it's got a lot of fat in it. Usually it's got a lot of salt and sugar. That's why it tastes so good. But it's irradiated. Yeah. A lot of our food is irradiated so it lasts longer. You know those bags of salad that we all buy? You know, really simple ones that are already mixed. Not only are they irradiated with, when I talk radiate, it's radiation. They also store it with gas. What's a gas? Not ethanol.
I'm not sure what they do.
They use a gas so that the lettuce doesn't go brown on the edges and last for a long time. Because, yeah.
So they gas it as a preservative.
Yeah, but they also radiate the food.
It's a gamma ray.
That's a gamma ray. They gamma ray it. And gamma radiation, when I was a nurse working in surgery in theatre, we used that as one of the sterilising ways for our dressings, our swabs that we use in operations. So be thoughtful how you eat. Enjoy a little takeaway. Enjoy a little, what do you call, zip-zip meal. I call them ping-ping meals because of the ping of the microwave. But when you're eating food like that all the time, you're getting very little nutrients. Yeah. So I'm dealing with patients all the time that don't cook for themselves. They work very stressful jobs. They're very competitive or whatever. They drink a lot because it's the culture in this country, also in Australia, to drink a lot. And there's no nutrition in alcohol, nothing except sugar. Yeah, and it makes you feel good too. Yeah. But but it's, you know, it's temporary. Because the thing is, remember how we talked about blood sugar levels? Yeah? Peaks and troughs. You know, when you drink, your blood sugar goes up and then falls down. If you think that, oh, I can't sleep tonight, you know, I'll have a little drink to help me sleep. It'll help you sleep. Your sugar level goes up. But then during the night, your sugar level drops and you wake up or you're restless and you break that circadian rhythm, that's your sleep rhythm in your sleep, and then you get a disturbed sleep, you wake up to pee and to drink water. We don't talk about sleep in our discussions here, but sleep for me as a chiropractor when I deal with people is essential, you know? Remember how I didn't talk to you about this, but I talk about it with my patients. Sleep is essential. That's when we do our cellular regeneration. Even as grown-up adults, we've done all our growing up, all our repair of ourselves, the repair of our busy mind, you know, to calm it down, occurs when we sleep. That's why when I deal with my patient, I always ask them about their sleep. And as practitioners, we need to ask about our patients' or clients' sleep. Because when you're only averaging, you know, 4 hours, 5 hours sleep, the actual REM sleep, that's the really deep sleep, I forgot what it means, rapid eye movement sleep, that really deep sleep, if you're not getting at least 5 to 6 hours, you have problems. And there's a lot of research about sleep. If you don't get sleep, you're not nourishing your body, you're not allowing your body to recover, to de-stress, to calm down your mind, and it makes you more
likely to have disease. I think stress, lack of sleep, has a huge impact on us. And I see it all the time with my work as a chiropractor, but as a nurse, but not understanding the sleep business until, you know, in the last, you know, 5 years. I will do some notes for all your people for next time. I've got a lovely...
I've got it recorded anyway, so...
Oh, thank you. No, but I've got actually, with my work, I give all my patients an information leaflet about sleep. I will send it to Paul so he can upload it to your portal.
Yeah,
because it's really basic, but it's research-based and it's really good. I'm in the process.
And that new lecture you're talking about, cardiovascular,
yeah.
I'd like you to include blood as well.
The blood goes with cardiovascular.
Because that would be really important for the
students.
Yeah,
but I think that's where we should start from.
Yeah, coagulation, anticoagulation,
all that. Well, that brings us to what the other things that the liver does. Thank you for that. That's more to the end. But, yes. So the liver also produces, number 10, clotting factors.
Yeah.
Clotting factors are important for us to stop ourselves from bleeding if we cut our finger. And there are a lot of inherited diseases, like hemophilia, where the cascade, if we do cardiovascular, within the clotting, with clotting, you have a cascade of, I think, nearly 12 factors that have to be in place and in sequence within your blood system, so that if you cut yourself, one triggers off the other, and you stop bleeding. If one of those factors is removed, that means the clotting cascade, that means the pattern is broken, you get abnormal bleeding. Something happens. And there are a lot of conditions, both inherited, that means you are born with it, or that you acquire if you have a traumatic injury. As a nurse, I've come across a lot of people who have massive blood loss. If you have a massive blood loss through, a car accident, internal damage of your organs, your body it goes into shock. And as at the hospital, they give you blood, they transfuse you with blood, that's red blood cells, concentrated red blood cells. That's not as good as transferring with red blood cells, with white cells, with fibrogen, with fresh frozen platelets. You need all those things in order to fix up the clotting cascade if it's abnormal. So that's a big topic. But in your case, you wouldn't necessarily see that type of client. But it's important to understand that when you have abnormal clotting, that means if your blood does not stop from bleeding, if you cut yourself, it doesn't stop bleeding, it means that you've got other problems. And as an acupuncturist, you know, you have to be very, very careful. Whenever I see anybody professionally, patients I'm talking about, I always ask them about what medication you're on. Have you got any bleeding tendencies? These are contraindications to our treatment as acupuncturists. In some cases, we've been treating people that we know that their clotting is a little bit strange or weak, but we have to be thoughtful where we work. For me personally, I can't deny people treatment when I know that the treatment itself will be more beneficial than some bruising. But you need to be aware of somebody's bleeding tendency, whether or not they've got a clotting problem, whenever you work as an acupuncturist. In my world as a chiropractor who does acupuncture, I always got to think about that, because when I adjust, I can cause bruises. If your clotting cascade, if you've got one of the stages out, you're going to bruise. You're going to bleed more. So as therapists, practitioners, you've got to be aware to always be safe and always think about your patient first, and you do a risk assessment. I think I talked about risk assessments before. You always do that in our work to make sure that you're always safe and that you're working within the boundaries. But when you're experienced, like Annie, Paul and myself, you can make a clinical decision on when to treat. I have patients that are on aspirin, you know, for heart disease. You know, if you've got a heart problem like angina, they will give you aspirin, 75 milligrams a day, to weaken one of the phases. It just weakens. It doesn't take it out of the clotting cascade, so your blood's not so sticky. Because if it's too sticky, you run the risk for stroke, embolism. Stroke is when you have a clot of blood to the brain. Embolism is when you have a clot of blood to the lungs. You can also get a clot anywhere in your body. Anywhere. So for those people who are at risk, they're given aspirin or other drugs that interferes with a clotting cascade. And as practitioners, experienced practitioners, we make a decision. For me, I kind of think, well, if I don't treat them, they're going to run a risk of, you know, having issues with their problem. But if they can cope with a little bit of bruising, and you tell them, you always give your patients, your clients, you always got to make sure that in order to get an informed consent, you tell them all the risks associated with it. So with my patients, I say, right, you know, Paul, you know, I really would like to do the acupuncture, but you most probably have a bruise when I remove the needle after manipulation, because I like manipulating my needles for some things, not always. I manipulate and I don't do Moxa because I'm scared of smoke. No, I'm not kidding. I use infrared.
Yeah.
I use an infrared lamp. Paul taught me how to do that. It's really quick, very efficient. And that way you can work through, do the most for your patient. And they might bleed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just apply pressure. You know, it might be a couple of spots depending on where you are. But you also need to be very thoughtful about where all the major blood vessels are in the body when you do acupuncture.
That should go in the next lecture.
Exactly.
Over the ones near the point, because I'm always bruising. And if you know exactly where they are, I can help.
Because I will create a talk on that.
Yeah, there's some down here that bruise a lot.
Yeah, because I'm digressing again, but it's important. So within chiropractic, we never go within the anterior triangle of the neck. And the anterior triangle of the neck is made up of the two muscles. I can't say it. It's the sternocleidomastoid muscle.
Yeah.
You know, you never work in front, only work behind it. Because here, you've got big carotid arteries from your heart to your brain. You've got superior vena cava draining blood, blue blood, to the lungs. So you've got a lot of blood vessels, and they're very close to the skin. So we never work in this area. And if we do, we have to be thoughtful of the person's anatomy. And, you know, we've all got the same things, but the way that we have our bodies mapped out with our nervous system, our lymphatic system, our cardiovascular system, that's the veins and arteries, is very individual. And that's why in Chinese medicine and in Western medicine, we always check where the pulses are. Wherever you have a pulse, you've got an artery. Remember that time you taught me the wrist formula? Lordy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm digressing again.
Yeah, yeah. But how to miss the radial artery.
Yeah, how to miss the radial artery. I was very, very lucky because I've done lots of advanced studies in physical examination as an advanced nurse practitioner. I know what to miss out on. But when I was working as a nurse, I used to have to find the radial artery so that we could cannulate it, so we could measure somebody's blood pressure, but also to take off arterial blood for analysis. When somebody's very sick, we need to have access to blood, oxygenated blood, that's red blood, from the artery, so we can check the levels of oxygen, the levels of waste products when they're sick. But as an acupuncturist, we've got to avoid that artery. And, you know, knowing your anatomy and being aware that everybody's different is great. But with arteries, you can fill them.
And you have to be careful because very occasionally people, the artery goes round there.
And
so you've got to make sure always that you feel it.
Yeah, I can't, you know, when I first saw you last time, we talked about observation, palpation. So you look at your patient without even touching them. You know, and sometimes you can see people's little carotid pulsate. Sometimes when you lie them down, even with their clothes on, you can see the abdominal aorta pulsating. You look and then you touch. Palpation means to touch. You know, you always got to ask permission to touch somebody whenever you work with them. You know, it's a very strange world these days. In my with my work, I always ask permission. I ask permission verbally, but sometimes I ask permission in my head because I think I connect with my patients in lots of different ways. But you always ask permission so that way the person can relax and you can feel. The other thing you do is you can listen. And one of those skills is using a stethoscope. So you can listen to that beautiful sound of the carotid artery when the blood's whooshing, whooshing. Oh, it's beautiful. And you know what? That's another thing that I'll do with the...
Yeah.
We'll bring in stethoscopes
yeah.
and we can listen. The more that you can go to the basics, the more everything will fall into place for you as practitioners. It's beautiful. And you learn. You learn. But visual observation is crucial. Palpation, touching somebody in an appropriate manner. If it's in a sensitive area, you've got to always obtain permission. Listening to the whooshing noise of the pulse or of their breathing. Listening when you're doing an abdominal examination of the fluid on the tummy, if they've got ascites. Because when you've got fluid on the tummy, ascites, it sounds like a drum. Yeah, it's incredible. And likewise, if you're doing, if you're listening to the lungs, if the lungs have fluid on them, there will be a dull sound when you listen. Or you hear, you can, if they've got asthma, you can hear the, when you take a breath in, the inspiratory wheeze or the expiratory wheeze. People with asthma, they usually have an expiratory. When they breathe out, they have a wheeze. Sometimes with hay fever, you can get like that. That's why I'm a little bit breathless today, because the pollen count is very high today and I choose not to take antihistamines. They do funny things to me. But yeah, there's lots to do when it comes to examining a patient, and those are the few things that we can talk, that we'll always talk about, and I'll try and feed it back to the basics for you. So where are we going? Oh, we talked this. The liver also stores iron, it stores vitamins, and let's have a little look at the vitamins here. A, D, E, K. K is very, very important. You know how we talked about babies when they're born, how they've got a very high level of red blood cells in their body, and they work really, really hard. Their little liver works hard to break down the excessive red blood cells. Because of that, their clotting can be a little bit, that means the stickiness of their blood can be a bit odd because they've got too much blood and the body's working hard to break down the extra red blood cells that it was born with because it was mixing with the mum. They can have clotting problems, and vitamin K is very essential in setting up that clotting cascade for the rest, you know, for their lives. So all babies are given an injection. It's an intramuscular injection, usually into the thigh, because you need a deep muscle, a big muscle to do that, of a vitamin K. It's called kanakin. And if you have a deranged clotting through trauma, remember we talked about trauma, a car accident, abdominal injury, given lots of blood products, red blood cells, fresh frozen platelets, plasma, fibrogen. If you're given all those blood products to help support your volume of blood that you've lost through trauma, I'm just using that as an example, they'll always give you vitamin K to help that process. It's all about balance. Okay, and of course, it makes vitamin A. We talked about plasma proteins for clotting. And, number 11. So, detoxifies the blood to rid harmful substances of like alcohol and drugs and other things. And some microorganisms. With my job as a chiropractor, one of the things that I always advise my patients is that they drink plenty of water, because wherever I adjust, there's a nerve, there's a blood supply, both artery and venous. Remember, artery is oxygenated blood, blue blood is veins, and a lymphatic system. A lymphatic system, remember we touched upon it last time, it's a system in the body that has no ducts. And it's all controlled by pressure in our body, but it's activated by skeletal muscles moving the lymph around the body. One side of our body, the left side, drains into the left side, the right side from that side. Another thing that could be mentioned as well. So, whenever we talk about that, whenever I talk about post-treatment advice, I would say drink plenty of water, because I'm moving lymph, which is the system in the body that collects the rubbish, processes it and gets rid of it. I'm pushing lymph into the circulatory system, the blood system. And if you don't drink enough water, you get these terrible hangover headaches. I also tell them, please don't drink alcohol. In my world as a chiropractor, as an alternative therapist, I should say, we see that as a toxin. Yeah, it is. It's a toxin. And I tell my patients, no tea and coffee with caffeine, and no tea and coffee that are decaffeinated, because the chemicals that they use to decaffeinate tea and coffee, regular tea and coffee, is more harmful to you than the caffeine. So I always say fruit teas are great. Red brush?
Red bush.
It's beautiful. Drink all that stuff and enjoy that, but don't drink the other stuff, because it puts pressure on your liver. Because remember, your liver is the thing that cleans the blood, filters the blood, detoxifies. It breaks down toxic substances like alcohol, drugs. You know, one of the worst things that you can do if you're a clubber is to drink and then do cocaine at the same time. I can't tell you what it does to the liver. It's just, actually people die from, not from the cocaine, but from the liver disease that it can trigger. Yeah,
they get heart attacks as well from it, though.
Yeah,
as well,
because it constricts the blood vessels. That's the oxygen vessels of the heart, and they can have heart attacks. As an intensive care nurse, when I was working in adults, we saw a lot of people, especially in the early 90s, when people would mix their drugs, and we used to call them the snowballers. Yeah, we gave them names. You know, these young people, sometimes older, they would do cocaine, they'll do ecstasy, they'll do, what's that other stuff?
Ketamine.
They'll snowball, they'll do all those things. On top of that, they drink, all in one night. And it's just too much for some people. Yeah. Especially if you're a small person, like you girls, it's just too much. It can just tip you over the edge. Anyway, I don't want to just tell you sad stories. So, common liver diseases. You got all the lists there, and you know, you've got a little diagram of a healthy liver. I'm going to show you a healthy liver, but it's a lamb's liver. Fibrotic liver, cirrhotic liver, cancer of the liver. Talking about cancer of the liver, just to let you know, the liver's a solid organ, really solid, like a kidney. And it actually responds very well to chemotherapy. But the chemotherapy in itself affects the liver too. Like, it helps shrink and manage the malignancy, but your liver's the organ that has to clean the toxins from the chemotherapy. So often enough, when you're treating a patient and in the Western medicine with chemotherapy, they use a system called a rescue system in between chemotherapy to help take the pressure off of the liver. And you know what they do? to help the liver recover from big doses of chemotherapy, they use high doses of vitamin B. Yeah. As part of the high doses of vitamin B and vitamin C, but we give it to patients intravenously, and that's known as a rescue therapy. There are other therapies that some people use that are naturopathic and homeopathic to help decrease or detoxify the liver. And I have friends that do this thing, detoxify the liver every month or every 2 months. I just say, why don't you just drink less? Be better. You know, people feel guilty. They think, oh, I'll do a little rescue remedy for my liver. Just drink less.
Hmm.
Any questions?
The color of the cauliflower.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I forgot about that one. Yeah. So, going back to the liver, it produces the bile as a breakdown of the red blood cells in the liver, and it gives our poo the color. You know, you can say to your patient, so, how often do you go? And they'll say, oh, maybe once a day. And I think, okay, that's fine. What color? And they'll just say, oh, you know. I said, no, please tell me. They'll say, oh, well, you know, it's a normal color. I said, what's a normal color for you? And usually it's, you know, brown, you know, that's fine. But when I remember once I had a patient, she had shoulder pain. And she was a bit chubby. She was blonde. She was about 40 years of age. And I didn't even touch her. I said, so what color are your poos? And she's thinking that I'm a real idiot. Why am I asking me about my poo when I've come to my shoulder and I need treatment on my shoulder? I said, well, let's just break it down. Went through all the things without touching her. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, she's got gallbladder disease. She has probably got stones, because you know why? Her poo was clay-colored. Clay-colored.
Yeah, I know.
What's that color? Like the color of your jacket. And she was really embarrassed to tell me, but I was very excited because I was able to think, you know what? It's not a musculoskeletal problem with the shoulder. It's a gallbladder, because when you've got an inflamed gallbladder, because the gallbladder sits near the phrenic nerve, and the phrenic nerve it powers the diaphragm, you get referred pain from here to your shoulder. So she had the classic symptoms.
Mm.
She was fair, fat, and 40. Lovely lady. And you know what? I didn't charge her. I just said, you know what? You've probably got cholecystitis. That means inflammation of the gallbladder. You've probably got a little stone blocking your biliary tree because your poo's not the right color. And, you know, you've got that shoulder tip pain, which is very distinctive when you've got gallbladder problems, because the gallbladder sits near the phrenic nerve. Yeah.
It can be a little bit yellow, the sign of it as well, a little bit. If it's yellow.
Yellow what?
A poo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Clay color. Yellow to clay.
To clay, yeah. Because I see it time to time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, even for us normally, I know, if I have a very fatty meal, the color changes a little bit. And I know that I've got a little stone there that sometimes comes and goes. And then sometimes it goes. And you can see, if you wipe yourself on the toilet paper, always look. You can see the green little grains of bile salts on
the toilet
paper.
Can you actually see that,
right?
Yeah. Cholecystitis.
No, when you've got bile stones coming through, salts.
Right, right,
yeah?
Okay.
Mm. Always ask. Don't be embarrassed. You can tell so much from somebody's urine, poo, and yes.
Yeah, no, just getting back to the babies. Obviously, it's very obvious in the babies, like, if most of them are jaundiced when just after the born, then their stool is a very sort of green.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like scrambled eggs usually.
Yeah, it's really, it's
and that's normal.
Serious, you know, because of the litter and
everything. Yeah, and you've got to always with babies, if you hopefully, you know, you'll treat babies one day when you're a trained and experienced practitioner. I choose not to treat babies with acupuncture because I'm not that confident. But I'm really confident chiropractically and with other things. Babies' poo can vary, especially if they're breastfed. Because, you know, they're a product of their mum, aren't they? So if you're breastfeeding your baby and you're having like too much acid, like oranges, clementines, their poos are going to be very loose. You know,
if you're having... can treat babies with very fine cosmetic needles.
Yeah, we talked about and this last time.
Yeah, it's a very powerful effect. You know, just little things like in and out, or even just once it's in, they're all right if it's small enough. But if the needle's got any thickness, they won't have it.
Yes. And you know, one day I'd love to do some work with you, Annie and Paul, with children. But at the moment in my life, it's a bit. I haven't got that room to get that skill up to scratch. Yeah.
John, there's a really interesting opinion. There's a folk remedy which is used widely practiced in America. It used to be practiced in the UK, but it died out. I'm forgetting rid of gallstones.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, you take Epsom salts to loosen up the tissue a bit for about 10 days. And then you drink a pint of olive oil.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah, I've heard
and
of that too.
And then you have some lemon juice with it. And then it's painless, generally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when you go to the toilet, I've done it once and
I think you're going
to
die.
The toilet the next day, the whole of the top of the surface of the toilet is filled up with tiny little gallstones.
Yeah, it's...
But it can't be great for the liver absorbing that.
You know what? It's not my area of speciality. I always got to... I'm not copping out. And I'll always say that I don't know everything. That's one thing that I'm not very good at with the naturopathic ways of cleansing the liver and stuff. I know that I have friends that do all that, but I'm not very specialist. I don't know much about that.
John, yes. I have a few questions.
Yes, please.
Relating to translating TCM terminology into medical functionality.
Sure.
And I think they all tally. So one thing is itchiness relating to the liver. A few
I'm
more.
Glad you
contractions,
that.
If it does. I think it does, glycogen or contractions or cramps.
Cramps. Is
okay, if you can explain, cramps, contractions. What about nodulation?
Well, nodulation, the liver?
Yeah.
General
lump formation in the body.
Yeah,
is there a connection?
Fat. Yeah, there is.
Yeah,
but that's
like, and what connections you can find?
So, that's a very good point, because when you have a raised bilirubin, remember bilirubin is one of the byproducts of breaking down old red blood cells. When you have high levels of bilirubin, not only do you have that little bit of tinge of yellow, not always, you have terrible itchiness all over. It's irretractable, you can't stop it. So that's another sign and symptom of liver disease in people.
And so we call that liver wind.
Liver.
It's quite interesting as well that with the itching is with the liver, with the heat, because the liver stores the iron.
That's right.
And also iron is one of the things that we can get that can actually help take the itchiness away. Because a lot of my patients, when I test them for iron as well, John, sometimes it comes up with B12, but sometimes it comes up without B12. And then... probably 50% of the time, maybe 60% of the time, that in itself will actually take away the itchiness.
Yes.
So, because obviously the liver heat and everything that works really well.
It's good that you mentioned the iron business, because, the liver stores iron.
Yeah.
And if you have too much iron, that's not good either. And that's one of the problems if you have thalassemia major. Does anybody know of this disease or condition?
Like a thalassemia, like Mediterranean anemia.
Yeah. So in my family, we have I have the thalassemia trait. So I'm a carrier of thalassemia. I have the trait which affects me a little bit in the sense that some of my red blood cells are normal, like round, like a disc. Red blood cells are like a disc shape. They're really microscopic. But sometimes they're produced in, they're odd shapes. And that means if you're odd shaped, you don't have the same iron carrying potential. The way that the red blood cells carries iron and oxygen isn't very good. So that's why I might look like a nice color, but I might have a low iron level. And with that, your liver works extra. And it stores extra iron. If you've got the full thalassemia, one of the treatments is to remove the excess iron building up in your liver, but also your bones, and they use a particular drug for that. You can never cure.
So is that why? Because it can affect the bone structure, can't it?
Yeah, it
so
does. Is because that they were really strong.
Yeah.
The bones are really, really strong.
Overly dense, is it?
Very dense. And they, you can see the orangey colour of the iron in the bones on post-mortem. Mm.
So that's another thing that's got to go in the blood thing.
Yeah.
Anemia.
I've got to write this down.
Yeah.
I've got to remember. You've recorded it, haven't you?
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, we can talk about it. I've got an idea.
Yeah.
I've built a picture of it.
Yeah. So and the other thing, you mentioned the liver.
Is there any connection? So you've got the itchiness relating to the bile not being expelled properly. Yeah.
And then you've got the nodules.
Is there cramps?
Yeah, but that's also to do with the salt, because bile is based... is a salt-based thing. So you're going to get... Whenever you've got low levels of salt in the muscles, when you've got excess bile, you've got it in one part of the body and not inside the cells. Yeah?
Yeah.
So that's where you get...
So it's excess bile in the blood will cause that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything in there that explains spasms?
Is it acid?
But... It's a combination of lots of things. You're right. It's a combination of lactic acid, uric acid, bile salts, regular salt.
Mm.
If you don't... When we do the musculoskeletal system, the way that muscles function, it's a change in concentration of salt from one to the other.
Mm.
That's how you get a contraction.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll talk
and
about...
And bile is composite in that.
Yeah. It upsets the concentration.
Okay, because
the osmorality.
We have this in TCM about liver causing cramps.
But that's the reason, because you get a change from a high concentration of salt to a low concentration of salt across the membrane, the semipermeable membrane.
Mm.
It's a bit scientific. I'm going to break it down so you can understand a bit more so with the next lecture. But you're right. The other thing you mentioned was the lumpiness.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yeah. Have you got an idea about that?
Yeah, I do, because it's all to do... You know, with the liver, it stores fat. If you have an abnormal liver, your fat deposition, the way that it puts fat throughout your body, can be unbalanced. Remember, your body's always trying to create balance. We call it equilibrium. If you have an abnormal balance, you get lumps. And there are certain conditions called... And we call them lipomas. A lot of people have them, where you find lumps in people. Some of these lipomas could be very small. They're usually non-malignant. That means they don't turn into cancer. But what happens is that sometimes they can grow. And if they grow above a muscle, that's fine. It's very mobile. You can push it around, and that's fine. But when it grows into muscle tissue or tendon sheaths, the sheaths that attaches the muscle to the bone or the ligaments within the joint, that's when it's a problem. And some people have a condition. What's that condition? Oh, well, they get lots of lumps all over them.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, it can be quite disfiguring. But there are triggers that causes that too in just regular people.
It's not that dangerous, though, is it?
No.
Painful.
No.
Just cat.
No, it's not.
Usually not even painful.
It's actually not painful. It goes into a tendon, into a muscle. It infiltrates from
you're moving the muscle, then it hurts.
Yeah, it hurts. And if you've got disruption within the myofascia, you're going to have disruption within the function of that muscle.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can affect the range of motion, the way that your arm moves, the way that, you know, that muscle moves, and you can get discomfort. Not
I've got one more
pain.
Question.
Yeah, yeah,
I don't
please.
Know if it's answerable.
No, ask.
But in TCM, the emotion associated with liver dysfunction or stress on the liver is anger.
Yeah.
And I wondered if that was explainable.
Yeah, well, you know what? It is explainable. You know how we talked about when the liver's not functioning properly, not doing its job. Remember, it does 23 major jobs. When you have an imbalance within the toxins that your body produces, and if your liver's not working properly to clean the blood, to filter, to break down drugs, break down red blood cells, to break down toxins that you're exposing yourself to, you get high levels of waste products. The same in kidney disease. Uric acid, urea, creatinine. These are all waste products of protein synthesis. When proteins are broken down into smaller amino acids, you get urea and creatinine. They change how somebody feels. They make them confused. In some cases, people can get very agitated. From a medical point of view, working with patients with liver disease, kidney disease, when they have high levels of urea, creatinine, they become very disorientated and angry.
Right.
So that's your explanation.
So it's urea and creatinine.
Yeah.
And when people drink and they get like that, is it similar?
No, that's to do with the way that the liver's just functioning and the effects of ethanol.
Ethanol.
Which is what alcohol is.
Right.
I forgot the formula of ethanol. H2CO2.
Something like rocket fuel.
Yeah. Listen, all I can say is enjoy a little drink, but just drink moderately.
Yeah, don't binge.
Yeah. And please don't binge. Yeah, I can tell the horror stories of that. And you know what? Everybody's got glazed looks on their eyes. You're going to go play.
Everyone's guilty.
Can I ask
two
questions? The first one was related to a while ago when you were talking about the case where you have the shoulder
the
phenic nerve. Is it only on one? Would it only be
only on the right shoulder?
Okay.
Isn't that crazy? Because of the map of the phrenic nerve, it goes to the shoulder. The referred pain goes to the right tip of the shoulder. Not even the back. It's the tip. Right here.
With the gallbladder, isn't there a situation, sometimes you have stones, but you can have like sandy particles.
Isn't that
cholecystitis, or it's different?
No, it's part of the whole process.
Right, right.
Because the stones can, your body's always trying to make it better, right?
Yeah.
It's always trying to create an equilibrium.
The stones can come out easily.
They've got to go in the right place. Because in the biliary tree is
the ducts, yeah.
The three little ducts,
bile
yeah?
ducts, yeah.
One from the liver, one from the gallbladder, and one from the pancreas, and it goes into your small intestine. If you get a stone from the gallbladder that blocks to the pancreas, you'll develop pancreatitis. If you have a stone blocking the duct from the liver, you get inflammation of the liver, which is called hepatitis. Hepatitis isn't always a disease process, bacterial or viral or pathogen. If it's a bacteria, of a protease or whatever, you get hepatitis. Hepatitis, when we talk about it in medical terms, is not always hepatitis A, B or C. And there's now new ones as well where you get a combination.
So it's not always infectious.
It's not always
caused
infectious.
By blockages and things
like
that.
It can be caused by blockages. And I talked about some of the treatments for liver. I forgot about going through that with you. Mm. Any other questions before we go and feel and touch?
I had one more.
Yeah.
When we were talking about different boosts for the liver, what is your thought about milk thistle?
You know, milk thistle is amazing to detoxify. I know that through my own experience. Milk thistle is a wonderful herb to use, or substance to use. It's not a herb. As a detoxifier of the liver. Yeah.
Let's ask about lumps.
Yeah.
So I have doing some sort of mild acupuncture on someone who had a lump around CV17.
Yes.
And she's vegan and has been quite angry for a few years.
Yeah.
And I basically did some sort of I was trying just needle stuff and nothing was happening, so I just did some Japanese acupuncture where you just touch the meridian basically.
Yes.
And it just went down, which is amazing. But now it's popped up again.
Yeah.
So do these lumps kind of go and come?
They can, because remember your body's always trying to get a balance, an equilibrium. I don't always understand the pathophysiology when that occurs, because like I said, everybody's makeup, where they put together is very difficult. But when you're talking about people, remember I touched upon it last time, in my world as a chiropractor and as acupuncturists, trained acupuncturists, we always consider, you've got your physical being and your psyche, the two are together. Mm. If you have an imbalance with your mind, you'll have an imbalance with your physical being.
You can never, ever disregard that connection between people, in people. Unfortunately, in Western medicine, they don't consider that. They just treat systems. And, you know, I am criticizing something that I've worked in for a very long time. And that's why it led me to Paul and Annie and my work with them and studies with them with acupuncture, because I needed something else to understand Western medicine. So if you can just always remember your physical being and your psyche, that means your mind, are one. If you get an imbalance with the two, or one or the other, it'll affect you.
So the connection between the liver, the lungs, and the emotions, can they join? Are there certain places where it all kind of joins together?
You know what?
Is there places around here?
Thing, you've got to remember too, if we're talking about who's familiar with chakras, where's that girl that did all the massage? That Italian girl. She's not here today. If you're familiar with chakras, the chakra here is a very important chakra. It's your cardiac chakra. I actually do a lot of work with that as a chiropractor. I don't tell the patients that I'm working on it because some of them don't understand. They don't want to know. But for those people who are a little bit open, I always talk about the chakras. And that's a very important chakra, especially with your emotions and your heart.
So it makes sense if someone's very angry, then stop getting a lump there. And
it does.
Suddenly feel better and it goes away. You feel worse again, it comes back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's probably lots of... What's your name again? I forgot. Adam. Adam, if that person was my patient or client, I would be looking at lots of other issues. And I would most probably, you know, refer them for additional care.
You went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, it's just because of your posture.
You know, that's a possibility too. But you've got to remember, without putting down general practice, general doctors, you know, they don't think about the other side of things. And this is why we're all amazing people, because we're looking and learning and wanting to learn more and understand more about ourselves, firstly, and how, as human beings, how we function. If there's one thing you can take away from today, is remember that drink in moderation, if at all. Remember your physical being and your psyche are one, and that everybody's, whether we're put together, is very individual, even though we've got two arms, two legs, and a head. But the way that our mapping of our nervous system, our cardiovascular system, that's the system of the blood, and our lymph system is very different. And of course, meridians of the body in TCM. But you know, as long as you stay open to that, and remember the other things we talked about with regards to looking at people, we always look first, observation. We listen to what they're saying without touching them.
Yeah.
And then obtain permission to touch them. We palpate, we listen, we look, and we feel.
And we smell.
Oh, it smells a big one. Yeah. You know, I don't discuss that with my patients, but yeah. I do. I do a lot of that. You can tell so much more. And you'll get more, as you proceed through your exposure to your clients, your patients, your learning, you'll get more and more. Now I've made you all paranoid about smells, haven't I?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like people with bad breath, you know, they're usually constipated, you know.
Yeah, can I tell a little story about one of my patients? Is that all right? I know I'm digressing again, but it's really important. Because we've got to touch as well, that liver. I had this lady, right? She was like your colouring. She had beautiful blue eyes, she had blonde hair, a little bit coloured, but, you know, she was sort of like a blonde underneath. She had grey skin, grey eyes, grey hair, and she smelled like shit. Even though when I was working with her, I could smell that she had a shower recently. I could smell her Dove. I know them all. I could smell her Dove soap underneath it all, but she smelled like shit. And she came to me with lower back pain. And I said to her during my consultation, I said, oh, how often do you go to the loo? La, 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 la. She goes, oh, every 10 days. This is, honest to God, I can tell you now, I can tell you like I saw her yesterday. Because she only went to the toilet every 10 days. During the consultation, she shared to me that she was in an abusive marriage, just in passing. But, you know, when people tell you little things like that, they're telling you for a reason. They either want to download and share and discuss it, or to just make you aware as a professional that something's wrong at home. And this goes on to ethics and law in our profession. as alternative therapists, chiropractors, whatever, we always have to listen to that stuff because people often want to share and talk. I encourage it with my work because that's my job too, to listen and to, you know, get rid of some of that rubbish verbally and let them talk. Anyway.
You can smell also congestion.
Oh, my God.
Nasal congestion or the...
Oh, it's awful.
You can just smell. You just got
smell. I mean, everything smells. I treated her just once. And, you know, in my work, I don't treat aggressively unless you've got a bulging disc in your lower back or wherever in your spine. I'll see people every 4 days for 2 weeks. Anyway, this woman, she came back a week later, and I looked at her. Remember, I didn't even touch her. I just looked at her, and I could smell her when she came in. I thought, oh, she smells a bit different. She looks a bit different. You know, her eyes were blue. Her skin was a little bit pink. Her hair was shiny blonde, naturally, well, a little bit dyed, but, and she smelled different. And I said to her, so, what happened since I last saw you? And she was in shock. She goes to me, John, I went to the toilet twice in a week. I said, wow, how did that feel? How did that feel? She goes, it felt very strange. And I said, well, what do you mean? Because I love getting them to talk. She goes, oh, it's just incredible. Anyway, I treated again, did my little thing. She came back the next week. She's becoming, you know, this woman was absolutely beautiful. I don't like talking about my patients in that way. Everybody's beautiful, but she was absolutely gorgeous. But I just didn't see it because she looked grey. She smelled like shit. Her hair was dull and lifeless. Her eyes were dull and lifeless. Her breath just was horrible. I saw her over 3 weeks, and I got her feeling more comfortable with her back firstly. It took her a little while to link, you know, the fact that she was extremely constipated to her back pain. But she got it at the end. She went on to divorce the husband and take off her career, and she's doing great. And I still see her now, eight and a half years later, strong and confident. But that's just a little example. Yeah,
Would you treat the sacral area?
You know what? I treat the kundalini in that situation. That's one of the chakras that are very particular to a woman. But what I didn't talk to her about those terms. I talked about lower back and lumbar region. Now, if you've got misalignments within your lower back, like lumbar 2, 3, it all feeds into your large bowel, and even lumbar 4 feeds into the bowel. But in her case, it was the pressure of all that shit that she keeps in her body pushing onto her back, causing her pain.
Yeah, right. She hasn't defecated, so
yeah.
Where's it going?
And like, you know, and of course, as I mentioned, she was in a difficult, abusive relationship. So only God knows what was going on with intimacy, whether or not it was consented or aggressive. Even being intimate when you're constipated is a bit hard. You know, just an example.
Quite a risk of appendicitis as well, if you get compacted.
Yeah, but that's if you get if your valve from the small bowel to the large bowel is ineffective. You know what? We're going to round this up now.
You've got to go and do
I've got to go and do the liver. I need you to touch and feel and look. If you don't want to touch, that's fine. Everybody's got a choice. And if you've got any questions, you've got my email. I included this time on your notes. If you want to ask me questions, that website. You know how I read the details about the alcohol consumption? You can just Google units per week, alcohol units per week, and you'll get it up. I only did it on the train coming here because I forgot to add it to your notes. So that's another thing I'm going to add.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Let's go and play.
All right, then. So we're going to go in the other room, yeah?
Yeah, because the light's
better. Okay, this is recorded for anyone new. So you will be able to access that on the Google Docs, the file that I sent you. You'll find in there this, it says recordings, and then you look in there and it will say the John Tickaroo and today, but I'll probably put it on there in 2 weeks' time. And there's other things, listeners, you can listen to anyway now.
There was on the news this week.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Big problem.
good here.
There you are.
Thank you. Yeah, grab a little bit.
All right.
No, you need two, darling. Yeah. And we'll put all the rubbish. The gloves we'll put behind here. The rubbish has to go into this bag when you finish. Oh, look, you don't have to record it.
Well, you might say something.
Oh, yeah? True.
Yeah.
Please do not put the gloves in this bin. Put them inside the bags that I left you, yeah? But I need you all to have a little play and a feel and look. I have to put this in just a regular magnifying glass, but it'll help you. And the light's really good here. So come closer so I can just show you. It's a lovely little thing, isn't it? It's beautiful. So even with the natural light, we can see the little hexagonal cells of the liver. So this is a lamb's liver, yeah? But it's about the size. If you look at a human liver, it's about that big. So with the naked eye, you can see the capsule. I've taken the little slice away here.
With
the naked eye, you can see the hexagonal shapes.
Yeah?
They're the insects, of course.
Absolutely.
And this is the portal vein. But look at the shape. Eye looks the same. So you can look with the magnifying glass. Don't worry about getting blood or anything on it. Because I just need you to play, yeah? Play and have a little look. One at a time. Gloves are behind you.
All right.
You'll
be fine. It's all recorded.
We used to call it the bucket. So the aim was after a game which we won was to drink 20 pints. That was the goal. So after 10 pints, you had a bucket. So then you vomit when you were sick, you vomit in the bucket. Yeah. And then when you got to 11 pints, you have to take that half pint out of the bucket.
Oh, they did it?
Yeah, we all did it. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know, it's disgusting.
It's going to make you ill.
Yeah, then you vomit again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you didn't feel great the next day.
Oh, so you
I'm surprised you can actually eat. Well, it was quite loose by that time.
Right.
But not nice if you had a curry first.
No.
Yeah. But didn't it make you puke? Yeah, a bit. But they puke a bit. Did you
kind of, they just have it and then they puke. And then
it's a ritual when you join, you have to do this.
Mm.
And then you
kind of
puke.
Yeah,
you have to do this.
Yeah.
And then it's a ritual when you join, you have to do this. Yeah, you're kind of puking, just gagging. Just as you're taking your gagging.
Yeah, but it's true. It's true. It's true.
But you are pissed.
Don't
all right then. You can
don't put any of the gloves in the bin, yeah? Or put them all there. And have a little touch in the surface feel. It's really good. It's like human liver. Can you see the little shapes? Isn't it beautiful? That pattern. Isn't that pattern beautiful? And it's natural.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We always put the rubbish in here. You don't want the blood going into the bin.
Yes. Can I ask a question?
Yes. Beautiful. Yeah, that's a chicken liver. Very rich in iron. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. I like chicken liver. It's great. My family are Greek Cypriot. We used to cook on the barbecue. Or we used to wrap bacon around them on the stick. Barbecue. My mum used to do them with onion and garlic and butter and olive oil. Oh, gorgeous. But you know, if you're a vegetarian, you don't want to eat
them. It's very nice, but later liver. You shouldn't eat liver.
Like I said before, it's all about moderation. You know, make sure if you have animal products that the animals have lived a good life, and free range or organic is best. Because you know, if they're organic, they would have been given good food, and hopefully they're happy animals. liver.
No,
no, no, no. Imagine the liver for nothing.
Yes.
No, but no, gosh,
lipomas. It's literally the fatty lumps, but the malignant. No, sometimes people can just, it's not associated always with liver. It's very rare, actually. But Paul mentioned it. And sometimes they just get bigger when they dissolve. Like Adam was talking about a patient, they have one here that comes and goes, or they can get bigger. It's when they infiltrate the muscle or the tendon and affects the movement of the body, that's when it's a problem. Yeah. I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I understand the pathophysiology of that, like I said. But everybody's different. You can't.
Yes.
Surgery. If they become too big. Yeah. You know what? Maybe Paul might have a better idea.
No, I won't put it in.
No, don't put it in. Maybe Paul might have a better idea, but I don't have an answer for that.
Completely, yeah.